DW Deutsche Welle. World Link.
Hello and welcome to this edition of DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early. On this week's show, mixed reactions in Egypt as three Al Jazeera journalists begin jail sentences.
Plus, a photographer who's captured the raw horror of war in a book with the controversial title War Porn.
And we look back on the life of a man who spent 15 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit.
Glass being put under their food, being hosed down with cold water, being left lying in the cell, being strip searched, left standing naked, not knowing whether it was day or night, lights left on in cells, and this was continuous.
These stories and more coming up on WorldLink. You're listening to DW's WorldLink, where I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early. This week, the sentencing of three Al Jazeera journalists in Egypt to 7 years in jail caused international outrage, but mixed reactions within the country. They were accused of aiding the now-banned Muslim Brotherhood in spreading false news. The three, Australian Peter Grest, Egyptian producer Bahir Mohammed and Cairo bureau chief Mohammed Fahmy, had been detained since December and all deny the charges against them.
One of Mohammed Fahmy's friends is Cairo-based journalist and television producer Sarah El-Sijani. Earlier, she told me how she and her colleagues reacted to the sentence, which saw the journalists become the story. Just a note, due to the poor phone quality, we've voiced over Sarah, but her words remain the same.
There's a lot of anger, a feeling of frustration and injustice. And not just from the defendants, but journalists attending the trial as well. Remember, we're not just colleagues, but friends. We know how these people conduct their work, and that they've got journalistic integrity. And to see a friend being sentenced to 7 years for doing his job is very difficult to stomach.
Now, you know at least one of the jailed personally, and you said they're not just colleagues but also friends. Mohammed Fahmy, who's Al Jazeera International's Cairo bureau chief, how's he coping?
I don't know how he's coping. He looked very angry and very frustrated.
I don't know how he's coping. He looked very angry and very frustrated. His family was very worried about his health. He had a shoulder injury prior to the arrest. He lost full mobility of his arm due to the lack of physiotherapy in prison. And he was looking for an acquittal. He knows his work. He knows he has no affiliation with the Muslim Brotherhood, much less membership in a terrorist organisation. And he wanted compensation for the time he spent in prison because he was expecting an acquittal based on everything we saw in court. So I'm really worried about him, and I can't imagine how he spent the first night in prison as a convicted person, knowing that he was unjustly tried and unjustly convicted.
Sarah, what sort of reactions have you been getting in Egypt this week? Are people buying into the claim that the journalists are guilty of terror charges?
Yes, the problem is
it's divided as everything has been divided in Egypt. The government has been conducting a very successful public opinion campaign, and details often aren't reported, and in it, details are not important. For some reason, people associate this injustice, this crackdown on dissent, as some sort of stability and safety and security for them, and the details often aren't reported.
So what do you think was this trial really about? Is it just about setting an example, or is there a deeper underlying motive? I mean, I've read in the press, for instance, that some say it's all just because of a political dispute between Egypt and Qatar, the country where Al Jazeera is based.
Definitely. International relations are part of it, but it's also domestic. It sends a strong message to journalists working here, especially foreign journalists who have been finding it very difficult to stay in line with the message that the government wants to broadcast. What we've seen is that not only can journalists be arrested, but they can be charged and convicted based on no evidence at all. So there's no justice system that you can rely on. For example, I keep thinking that if I do something that really irks someone in the government, then I can be put in prison, full stop. And this also conveys an image to Egyptians here who support the current regime and support these practices, that it's cracking down on dissent and on their supposed enemies.
Sarah, given that the verdict sparked broad international outrage and protests, How likely do you think is it that an appeal might be successful or that Egyptian authorities intervene to free the journalists?
The government doesn't care. It doesn't care.
The government doesn't care. It doesn't care about international pressure or its international image. So this is how they're going to proceed. And people have accepted that. If you remember, less than 24 hours before the verdict, US Secretary of State John Kerry was here in Egypt and he released $500 million in aid. The government in Egypt has been getting away with a lot of things, and we're seeing a return of the Mubarak era, where everyone was very willing to look the other way and turn a blind eye to Mubarak's practices domestically, which don't even compare to what's happening here. Now it's much worse, and the abuses are bolder. But the international community is willing to turn a blind eye to this for the sake of restoring relations with a strategic regional ally.
Sarah, I'd like to end the interview on a personal note. As you just described, it's become rather risky to work as a critical and independent journalist in Egypt. Will you be changing anything with regard to your own work, considering that you might be locked up for what you report on?
No, but it makes you think every time...
No, but it makes me think every time I take a camera out. I work for TV, but at the end of the day, you really cannot change reality. I simply can't report something different to what I'm seeing just because I might be locked up. It contradicts the basic reason why we're working as journalists. We're here to report as journalists, full stop. And if you don't portray a real image of what you see around you, then there's no point working as a journalist. And it's a job that I really enjoy and believe in.
Thanks to Sarah El-Sirjani speaking with me from Cairo there, and to Helen Sini for the voiceover. Tributes have been paid in Northern Ireland to Gerry Conlon, who died last week at the age of 60 from lung cancer. He was a victim of one of the most grievous miscarriages of justice that the UK's ever seen, spending 15 years in prison for being part of an IRA gang who bombed two pubs in Surrey, England in 1974, killing five people and injuring over 60. They became known as the Guildford Four.
But in 1989, their conviction was quashed and Gerry Conlon was freed. He went on to write the book Presumed Innocent, upon which the Academy Award-nominated film In the Name of the Father was based. In Belfast, a close friend of Gerry tells us about the man she knew. For DW, Richard Murray has this report.
We're on the Falls Road. It's quite wet here at the minute and there's a lot of traffic up and down. Gerry would have often probably come up this road. We're not too far from where he lived. There's still a lot of atmosphere about it. People would know each other very well, and this would be a road where Gerry Conlon would have been very well recognised on.
That's Margaret Walsh. She was a good friend of Gerry Conlon for 20 years and grew up near him in West Belfast.
I was 20 when the Troubles broke out. I always remember the first day of the Troubles because it was a beautiful day, but you could feel the tension in the air. You could feel there was an atmosphere about that wasn't normal. My sister and I were on our way up to the chip shop when we met this crowd coming down the road, and the two of us turned and we ran home. People were absolutely petrified of what was going to happen, but we also thought that it would be very short-lived, you know, it would be a day or two.
Margaret didn't know Gerry before his conviction, but they became close when he was freed, and she was a Belfast city politician representing the nationalist SDLP.
Got to know him through his sister. I actually was just mesmerised by this guy because he was just a very charismatic person, very interested in what was going on. He wouldn't hold back. He would tell you as it is. And he would tell you about his father and that, you know, and about his father dying in prison. And, you know, why should people be left to suffer who didn't commit these crimes? Because the people whose families had lost loved ones needed answers as much as the people that were convicted did.
Gerry was arrested after his name was given to detectives by a friend who was beaten and made to list every Irish person he knew who'd been living in London at the time of the bombings. There was no evidence to link Conlon to the crime. Two bombs at two public houses in Guildford in Surrey, about 45 kilometres from London. The explosions killed five people, four military personnel and one civilian, and marked the start of a campaign of attacks by the IRA. Police were desperate to get an arrest, and Conlon's face fitted. Jerry told Margaret about the day he was taken into custody.
The army and police came and lifted him. He was taken to Springfield Road Barracks, and it was obviously things had happened there. He was tortured and whatever. He was then being told he was getting taken over back to England. His father, Giuseppe Conlon, who wasn't a well man, told them in the police station, on the advice of his solicitor, that he was going over to England to look after his son to try and get him released. Giuseppe went over, and as the story goes, he left the suitcase down in the house, and the next thing, the family were all lifted. The Maguires were lifted, Giuseppe lifted, young children taken away. Jerry Conlon blames himself for his father's death. Jerry believed if he hadn't been lifted, his father would never have died in prison. And only a few weeks ago we had been speaking about this, and I'd said, you have to realise it was the British government and the IRA. The IRA should have actually told the truth, who had done what. And the British government did know that Jerry Conlon, the Maguires, the Birmingham Six had nothing to do with those atrocities and should never have left those people to rot in jail.
But Jerry did spend 14 years behind bars for a crime he didn't commit and had some pretty horrific experiences.
I said about glass being put into their food, being put into prison cells, being hosed down with cold water, being left lying in the cell, being strip searched, left standing naked, women coming in and making remarks about them, not knowing whether it was day or night. Lights left on in cells, and this was continuous. There was a prisoner who he had known quite well. This guy went up and just killed another prisoner while Jerry and all was standing there, and he was able to recall all the things that had happened. You could have said 1st of July 1982, what happened, and Jerry would have been able to just tell you everything that had happened that day. He was still living with that prison sentence.
Inconsistencies with the Guildford Four convictions began to come to light as the IRA's violent attacks on Britain continued. Campaigners worked tirelessly through the 1980s to clear their names. This culminated in their release from prison in 1989, when it was proven that the four were not involved at all in the attacks, and their confessions, which had been quickly retracted, were the result of police brutality. All convictions were quashed. Attentions then turned to getting an apology for the Guildford Four, and that took another 16 years.
This is the apology that Tony Blair gave to the families on the 9th of February 2005. The Guildford and Woolwich bombings killed 7 people and injured over 100. The loss suffered by their families will never go away, but it serves no one for the wrong people to be convicted for this awful crime. It is a matter of great regret when anyone suffers a miscarriage of justice. There was a miscarriage of justice in the case of Jerry Conlon and all the Guildford Four, as well as Giuseppe Conlon and Annie Maguire and all of the Maguire Seven. And, as with the others, I recognise the trauma the conviction caused the Maguire and Conlon families and the stigma which wrongly attaches to them to this day. I am very sorry that they were subject to such an ordeal and injustice. They deserve to be publicly and completely exonerated. And it's signed by Tony Blair. When we got to Westminster that day, there was nothing being said on the floor of Parliament, which we thought was going to happen. And we were then brought round, the Maguires and Jerry and his family were all brought round to the private chambers. And he spoke to Jerry at length. There was a lot of tears and crying. But there was also a lot of promises given on that day. And unfortunately, when we got the apology, we never got psychiatric help that was required. Being thrown out on the street after 15 years of imprisonment, not knowing what life was like on the outside. And one of the things that Jerry said that he found really strange when he came out of prison was when he got up out of bed in the mornings, he stood at the door because he waited for the door to open for him. Your food was brought to you, you just went and queued up for your food. So now you had to decide what time is he going to get up and get his breakfast.
Jerry's understood to have received compensation of around £500,000. And spent the last years of his life working to help other people who've been victims of miscarriages of justice. But years in solitary confinement with extreme temperatures in prisons, often very hot in summer and extremely cold in winter, had taken their toll on Jerry's health. And earlier this year, he was diagnosed with lung cancer.
For me personally, it's a privilege actually knowing him. He was just a lovely person. Sorry. Jerry would have lit a room up when he walked in. You know, I remember him and I going to a meeting one night, and he said to me, "Now, Margaret, if I don't feel comfortable and I want to leave, we're going." And there was a lot of ex-policemen and serving policemen in the room and people who were from the Protestant background there. And him and I sat, and he didn't leave the room. And people were looking at him and they were going, "I know him." And one guy in particular came over to him and he says to him, "It's a real pleasure to have you here." He says, "But you know what has impressed me? You have actually sat tonight listening to other people telling their stories, and not once did you get up to tell your own story." That was the type of person he was at times. When he wanted to just sit and listen, he would have. And only last week, he got out of hospital on the Monday, and on the Tuesday night I was in the house with him, and he was sitting in the chair with the oxygen and that on, watching the football, and he was finding it difficult to breathe, and he was calling for help. And then he'd turn around and he'd say, "Look, see this 75-year rule, this Official Secrets Act? We have to get those papers released." And this is in the middle of watching a football match, and at the same time hardly being able to breathe. He was fighting to the very end. That is, you know, a memory I will certainly always have of him.
Margaret Walsh, friend of the late Gerry Conlon, ending that report by Richard Murray. The horror of war is never far from the headlines. Just this week, the organisation Human Rights Watch said it had evidence which strongly pointed to at least 160 people being executed by the militant group ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria in northern Iraq.
Photographer and journalist Christoph Bangert is no stranger to such atrocities. He's covered war and crises worldwide, including Indonesia, Lebanon, Afghanistan and Iraq. He's seen conflict up close and caught it on camera. His latest book, called War Porn, is a collection of his photographs from the past decade, which media editors refused to publish because they were so graphic.
Earlier, we spoke to Christoph from his home in Switzerland. We began by asking him how he became a photographer.
That's a tricky question to start out with. It just happened like this. It was a bit of a coincidence. I was supposed to be a mechanical engineer, and I started to study mechanical engineering, which I really hated so much, so I desperately looked for something else. And I always liked to take pictures because of my travels. I was always traveling. And so I applied to photography school and I became a photographer.
And then, Christoph, from that, what led you then to go into war photography?
Another one of these coincidences, actually. It wasn't planned that way. It just happened. I took part in a student exchange program with the Israeli photography school in Jerusalem. And I lived with an Israeli family, and I spent my days in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, which drove my host mother crazy because she was so worried about me. But I realized how much I liked to be in difficult and interesting situations like this. And from that time on, I just kept going to these places.
Now, Christoph, you've compiled all sorts of pictures from conflict zones, and you've called your latest book War Porn. Can you please tell us, how did you decide on that title?
Yeah, the title is it's not very layered. It's a very rough, controversial title. The term war porn, or the accusation of pictures coming out of conflict zones being pornographic or voyeuristic, it's always an argument that people who criticize this sort of work bring up. And I thought I'd just turn this around. What I'm saying is, calling this sort of work pornographic or dehumanizing is always possible. It's always, in a way, accurate. You cannot avoid the dehumanizing element of in this work because the deed, the actual things that happen to these people is so dehumanizing that there is always a trace of this in the picture. But to call this work pornographic is also just an excuse not to deal with these pictures and not to deal with these events.
Why do you want people to look at these images? And this book is made of pictures which your editors at newspapers and magazines and websites had refused to publish because they were too graphic.
Almost all the pictures in my book were never published before. And this book is, in a way, also an act of frustration and anger on my part that I have all this material and nobody's ever seen it. We have to show these things. It's part of our duty as journalists to show these events in a comprehensive and complete way. We cannot just leave out a certain aspect, even though it is hard to look at these images, and we have to basically force ourselves to look at these images, we still have to do it. We cannot just avoid to acknowledge these people suffering by ignoring this sort of material.
Christoph, it's obviously your job to take these photos, and you're in situations that are pretty horrendous. A lot of the images are very sickening. How do you deal with these images when the camera is switched off?
Well, while I'm working, it happens very fast. I'm working very intuitively. It's not planned. It's not a conceptual kind of work. So I'm trying to be as professional as possible. And then the whole reflection part and thinking comes later when I edit the work. And that is much, much harder, actually, than being there with the camera, which is relatively easy. But later, of course, it's hard to deal with these images because it's not only these images that I have, but it's also these memories of my experiences that are very much attached to these images. I've been really struggling with this while I was putting together the book. What's important is to think about and to talk about how the people that I photograph are dealing with their trauma, because these people have no choice. They cannot jump into an airplane like I can and just go home. These people are home. The war came to them and they have no choice.
Christoph, did you ever take a photo that was even too graphic for your book that you deleted?
The book is basically an experiment. I wanted to know what would happen if I switch my own self-censorship off. It's a book full of my most horrible pictures. There are pictures in it where you see, for example, victims of the violence between Shiites and Sunnis in Baghdad, in Iraq, people that fell victim to this sectarian violence and were kidnapped and then killed. A lot of these people were tortured to death. And that is very difficult to look at. Your first reaction is to look away and you want to close the book and never look at it again.
You ask yourself this question in the book. Do you exploit your subjects, those people in your photos?
The exploitation dilemma is similar to the pornography dilemma. There will always be this trace of dehumanization in the work, and there will always be a trace of exploitation in the work, because the person that I photograph loses the ability to control his or her own image. But I, as the photographer, I have this ability to control the image, to publish the image, to do with the image whatever I want. That's a huge responsibility. And just because these dilemmas of the exploitation, the dehumanization that exist, that doesn't mean that the work is without value or that it is morally wrong to look at these pictures. I think that these are just excuses.
If you could choose one picture from the book that you could present to the world tomorrow, which one would it be and why?
If I would have to choose one, there is the one of this victim of sectarian violence. That person was left on the trash in Baghdad, and apparently his head was partially cut off, and then there were lots of wild dogs that roamed Baghdad and who had found the body and had started to eat the body. Maybe that's one of the pictures I would like people to see, because It's easy to read in the newspaper about sectarian violence and these things. It always seems quite abstract in our society, where we hardly know the difference between Sunnis and Shias. But if you see this image, you actually realize how horrible, how unimaginable these events are.
Thanks to war photographer Christoph Bangert, speaking with us from Switzerland. You're listening to DW's Worldlink. I'm Samantha Early.
And I'm Neil King.
This is DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Samantha Early.
And I'm Neil King. As the Football World Cup rolls on, we meet the team of the People's Cup, protesting rising housing costs in Brazil.
We also find out how a young woman in Detroit uses a sewing machine to bring opportunities to the city's homeless community.
It's pretty amazing in the interview process when somebody starts, you know, crying on the phone purely because you called them back. Just called them to schedule an interview, not even after the interview, not even during the interview, not even when they found out they had a job. This woman started crying on the phone, knowing that she had the opportunity to go in for an interview.
And it's Pride Week in Turkey. We meet members of the country's LGBT community facing an increasingly conservative government and society. Those stories and more coming up in the next half hour here on Worldlink.
The 22nd Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual and Transsexual, or LGBT, Pride Week is taking place in Istanbul, Turkey. The annual seven-day event, filled with film screenings, panel discussions, workshops, parties and marches, attracts thousands from around the world.
But Turkey's government and society is becoming increasingly conservative, making life more difficult for those that are LGBT in the country. Discrimination, intimidation and even murder against the community are on the rise. Natalie Carney met up with a few people taking part in the LGBT Pride Week to find out what it's like to be gay or transsexual in one of the largest Muslim countries in the world.
About 25 people crammed into a hot, stuffy room built for maybe 10. The organizers clearly did not expect there to be such an interest in Barış Sulu's film Dikkat Okulda Trans Var, or Warning There Are Transsexuals at School.
The reason I made this film was to increase the visibility of trans males in Turkey and reflect the difficulties and struggles they face in schools.
Barış was inspired by his boyfriend Ali, who went through the transition, as they call it, when someone changes from one sex to another. In Ali's case, he went through a number of operations 3 years ago and is now physically a gay man, a process that's legal in Turkey.
There have been laws regarding transsexuals since the 1980s, which were established even before Europe was. It is in the Civil Code in the 14th article.
Turkey's Civil Code loosely protects the human rights and freedoms of its citizens, but many say that it does not go far enough to protect the community from hate crimes. Intimidation, beatings, and even murder are not uncommon in the LGBT community. While there is a law against hate crimes in Turkey, punishable with up to 3 years in jail, it does not include sexual orientation. Neshi, a gay transsexual, says she is a victim of this deficiency in the law.
Hate crimes against women, gays and transsexuals have increased. Hate in general is on the rise.
bir nefret suçu arttı.
This tall, slender woman says you can't take anything for granted, such as renting a house or accessing regular health or social services, because while she may dress female, she is still biologically a gay man, something Turkey's conservative society struggles to understand.
Turkish society is very religious, and being transsexual or gay is not accepted by Islam.
Even her own family has rejected her.
When I was a child, I dressed like a boy. My parents are very religious, of course, and I am a Muslim.
She daintily tucked her long blonde hair behind her left ear under a cute pink baseball cap.
My environment was very religious. Some accepted me, some didn't. Because of these reasons, I only see my sister, but the other members of the family, I just speak to them on the phone.
She hasn't seen her mum or dad in 15 years. They didn't even come and visit her in jail. Neshi spent a year behind bars while on trial for allegedly stabbing someone. She says her crime, in the eyes of the police, was being a transsexual.
It happened on the highway. Pedestrians started fighting with drivers. I was just watching from the side, but the police still arrested me, even though people told them that I wasn't a part of this fight.
She was placed in an all-male jail where she says both the other inmates and guards treated her like an object from a freak show.
People are shocked when they find dinosaur bones. I was something like that for them. They were always staring at me. They were staring at me with open mouths, but I was very tough. The guards wanted to cut off my hair, but I refused. I'm a transsexual. I have boobs. I have hair. I'm a woman, so I didn't let them.
She was eventually acquitted with no compensation. But she says the system is getting worse for people like her and is concerned about the government's plan to build a prison especially for the LGBT community.
That special prison project is a sign. The punishment for sexual crimes in Turkey is increasing. I'm not optimistic. I think it's a game the government is playing with us. There are no friendly laws or codes for us. The new Turkey is like Iran. We are suspicious of the future.
The screening of Barış's film, a lady speaks up about her acknowledged bias towards homosexuals. Her comments were greeted with supportive smiles. Despite the pressure many feel from the conservative elements in the government and society, many still attend the Istanbul Pride Week and other such events in Turkey to seek a better understanding.
I am very happy to be very open with you because I value this awareness. Information is a very dangerous weapon, so we have to manage it carefully.
This week will conclude with the 12th annual Pride March down Istanbul's renowned İstiklal Street. More than 10,000 people are expected to attend the walk, waving rainbow-colored flags. Yet many will also be asking how much longer such celebrations for the LGBT community will be allowed.
Natalie Carney reporting from Pride Week in Istanbul, Turkey.
For more information, go to our webpage, dw.de.
In Sao Paulo, Brazil, for just over a month now, close to 5,000 destitute workers have occupied a piece of land, setting up a crude camp that resembles a tent city. The occupiers say they are campaigning for more affordable housing in Sao Paulo and say that real estate speculation connected to the Football World Cup has left them homeless. Sam Cowie reports.
Ocupação Copa do Povo, meaning People's Cup occupation, literally looks like a refugee camp. Hundreds of crude tents made from wood and black tarpaulin are stacked closely together, covering an entire hillside. The camp is in Sao Paulo's East Zone, about 4 kilometres from the newly built Itacarau Stadium, where the World Cup opening match was played. A wooden shack at the camp's entrance is used as an office where occupiers can register and borrow tools to build their tents. It bears the red flag of Brazil's homeless workers movement, MTST, which stands for Movimento dos Trabalhadores Sem Teto.
Creemos que nossa luta não está sendo em vão.
44-year-old Des Reyes is one of the camp's coordinators. He spent 3 years living on the streets of Sao Paulo before joining MTST. Since then, he has worked at several homeless camps across the city. He says that he and his colleagues set up Ocupação Corpo do Povo to pressure the government into building more public housing units for poor families.
Our fight is for dignified housing. Rent prices have risen, especially with the arrival of the World Cup. Living costs have risen too, making it even more difficult. So we opened up this camp here on the city periphery, where the most poverty-stricken people live. These people couldn't afford to pay rent anymore, so they came here. There are families and children living inside the camp too.
Des Reyes and around 2,000 others arrived here on the 2nd of May. After removing rubbish and cutting down shrubbery, they set up building tents. The land is privately owned and long abandoned. There is only one source of running water and one toilet, built from salvaged wood. Women who work as cooks in the camp are washing their pots and pans. Children are playing football and flying kites. 63-year-old pensioner Clergy Conceição says that she came to the camp after she saw it on TV on the 6th of May. She was living at a friend's house because she couldn't afford to pay rent. She lives at the camp with three great-grandchildren, a grandchild and her son-in-law. She says there isn't enough public housing in Sao Paulo.
Public housing here practically doesn't exist. Decent living conditions are only for those who earn 5 or 10 times the minimum wage. If you only get the minimum wage, it's like you have no right to dignity.
19-year-old Albert Costa takes me on a tour of the camp. He works mucking out stables for a wealthy landowner. His girlfriend is pregnant and is staying at the house of a relative. He says that he came to the camp in the hope of securing public housing for his family. Each tent is marked with a number. On the way through, a man is making repairs to his tent. A girl in a wheelchair, who looks about 10 years old, watches him. Albert takes me to the top of the camp where there is a view of the Itacarau Stadium. The camp is split into 8 groups. Each group has a kitchen with a gas stove. Here, the poorest families can get a free basic meal of rice, beans and vegetables. Food donations are made by occupiers who are better off. The majority of the tents have little more than a mattress and maybe a small table inside. Many don't even have this. In Sao Paulo, unlike tropical Rio de Janeiro, nighttime temperatures can drop as low as 5 degrees. 27-year-old Clayton Sicocci, an unemployed bricklayer who was homeless before coming to the camp, says that his dream is to secure public housing so that his children can come and live with him.
People need housing, but they also need food and clothes. It's difficult. A minimum salary can't cover all of these things. So lots of people left their rented accommodation to come and live here. We're sleeping in the tents and suffering now, but we're suffering in the hope that in the future, this land will be ours, God willing. I have faith in this.
On June the 9th, local government announced that they would build 2,000 public housing units on the site of Camp Copa do Povo after an agreement was reached with the landowner.
Mm-hmm.
19-year-old Albert, awaiting the birth of his first child, says that he cried tears of joy. Des Reyes, Clergy, Clayton and the rest of the camp are equally ecstatic.
Sam Cowie sent us that report from Sao Paulo, Brazil.
Living rough for a long, long time. Only my bottle treat me kind. Everything I got's in a shopping cart. Summer's all right, but winter time's real hard.
We're sticking with the issue of homelessness now, but heading further north to the US city of Detroit. Since the decline of its manufacturing industry and the global financial crisis, it's become a symbol of urban decline, representing the flip side of the American dream. But one young woman's simple idea is providing opportunities for the city's homeless. Nadine Wojcik reports.
3 years ago, Veronica Scott had an idea. Back then, she was studying product design in Detroit, a degenerating city with a high crime rate and an estimated 35,000 homeless people.
And that's a sleeping bag. I want to make it as simple as humanly possible to use. You pull the sleeves in. Definitely acts like a pillow and or vent for some air that you're expelling, because you don't want condensation to build up in the coat.
Veronica Scott was just 20 years old when she came up with this simple yet ingenious idea. She created a special winter coat that transforms into a sleeping bag, a garment that aims to improve the lives of the many homeless people in Detroit. The project was part of her design degree.
In school, you're trained to do design, and you're trained to do research in a very specific way. You're like, well, I'm going to bring sticky notes, I'm going to bring disposable cameras, and I've got interview questions. And I went into one of the roughest shelters in Detroit, and I went in there with all this stuff that meant nothing to anybody, and that nobody was going to respond to me having sticky notes. I decided that none of that was going to work. None of what I had really been taught to do was going to work, so maybe just sitting and listening would. And all of a sudden, there's a whole group of homeless people in Detroit that I became very close with.
Veronica continued to go to the shelter 3 times a week, even after the semester ended. Together with a group of homeless women, she kept refining the design for her sleeping bag coat.
By the end of all that, that same group was asking, well, when is this going to become a reality? Like, when am I going to get my coat? And I had no idea what to answer them with, because I'm like, as a student, you're just like, never. You know, we don't design things for reality, we do it for our portfolio. So many people wanted it there that I figured, why not try? I'm broke already. I live with my grandparents. I don't own anything. What would failure be? There's probably nothing that I could lose. And it was really exciting, that kind of freedom.
So Veronica asked her dean at college for help. He hooked her up with Carhartt, a company that makes work clothes. They agreed to supply her with materials, fabric, and sewing machines. The project went viral. Financed only by a donate button on her blog, she suddenly got together enough money to produce the sleeping bag coats. Veronica called her project the Empowerment Plan. She quickly realizes it is not only about her good textile design.
When I went back to the shelter with a very much improved design, I was leaving and a woman started screaming at me. And she says, well, your coats don't matter. And she was swearing and everything. She's like, because jobs matter. And your coat doesn't matter at all. You know, it doesn't mean anything. And she was yelling this at me, and I talked to her for a few minutes and then I left. And she's completely right. Because at the end of the day, a coat is a coat. It's not anything that's going to drastically change the world. It's more of a vehicle for them to learn a skill set.
Today, Veronica Scott is able to employ 6 women. All of them were homeless before. They produce up to 25 coats a week and give them away for free to homeless organizations all across the U.S.
Just keep going all the way across. Just keep going all the
way. Alicia is one of the seamstresses. She was the first person Veronica Scott was able to employ. Back in 2011, the two of them worked in a closet of a room with no windows. They were not even able to spread out the full coat. The room was just too small. Before meeting Veronica, Alicia was way off track.
Well, you know, I was living a lifestyle that was beyond my means, and I got caught up in it. You know, I was working the bars, and I was started off as a stripper. I just wanted the euphoria of just being happy and getting high. And as I started drinking, my drinking became very out of control. Then it was the drinking and the smoking weed and then the smoking the cigarettes. Then it escalated into cocaine.
Alicia ended up on the streets, not able to take proper care of her 2 sons. Shelters and transition housing were her new homes. With no job, there was no way out. Then she saw Veronica's job offer, a sign reading seamstress needed, at one of the shelters. She applied and got the job. Soon she was able to rent her own apartment and take care of her sons again.
You know, I just thanked God because someone had a heart, you know what I'm saying? Because she steady reaching back into the cesspool of homelessness, you know, to pull young women such as myself and other women out of transitional living facilities and homeless shelters, and she giving us a chance to become self-sufficient in today's society. You know, I really didn't look at the age. I was just grateful for the job and, you know, that she's so passionate and adamant about what she does. So I was really grateful about that.
With more private sponsors and funds coming in, Veronica now is able to rent a grand space in a former factory building, now hosting the new creative industry of Detroit. All of Veronica's seamstresses have similar stories to tell, now with a happy end. Annis, sitting at a sewing machine, ended up on the street after a drug addiction and 6 years in prison. The job is her second life, she says. She still has a text message her son sent her on her cell phone.
He says, "Morning, Ma. I just wanted to say I love you, and I don't think I could be any more proud of you at this point in our lives, Ma. I always knew you would find your way back to you if given time, and you did. And for that, I'm unbelievably proud of you. Never count you out, they'll say." So I have it locked in my phone.
For Veronica, it is still a little bit strange. Most employees call her Miss Scott or Boss Lady, even though she could be their daughter.
It's pretty amazing in the interview process when somebody starts, you know, crying on the phone purely because you called them back. Just called them to schedule an interview, not even after the interview, not even during the interview, not even when they found out they had a job. This woman started crying on the phone knowing that she had the opportunity to go in for an interview.
Back in high school, Veronica had thought she wanted to make money and live a fancy lifestyle in New York City. But her talents, her creativity, and her strength have pulled her in a completely different direction. But she is loving all of it, she says. How did the empowerment plan change her?
A completely different person. That's the best way I can put it. You know, this isn't something that I expected to do, especially as an art student. Business is not something you think that you are capable of. But I realized through this there's 1,000 different ways to apply creativity.
Veronica Scott, ending that report by Nadine Wojcik in Detroit.
It started out as a daring idea to get Muslims, Christians and Jews together in a Muslim country to sing about the very thing that was dividing them, religion. Today, the World Sacred Music Festival in the Moroccan city of Fez has become a beacon of religious tolerance in the middle of the Muslim world. John Lawrenson has more.
In Fez, at sunset, the Swifts go crazy. Hundreds of them swoop and shriek. When the sun disappears, they fall quiet, and the Sufis start singing. In some parts of the Muslim world, some see sacred music as a contradiction in terms. In Algeria, extremists assassinated some of the country's finest musicians. In Mali, more recently, others made bonfires for musical instruments. But Fez, the city they call the soul of Morocco, is a centre of Sufism, the mystical, musical, more peaceful current of Islam. I've seen non-Muslims singing along to a chorus about Allah, and Muslim families, the women's hair hid under headscarves, applauding a sung version of the Lord's Prayer. At a hotel near the airport where she's staying with her husband, I go to meet the Lebanese singer Ebiya Nemi, star of the festival's opening night, a Christian. The lobby is noisy, so we go into an empty bar that smells of stale cigarettes. Here, she agrees to sing a song in Aramaic, the language Jesus spoke. A song, it's one of the beauties of music, that's as fresh as it was when it was sung 2,000 years ago.
And then it's called like, Moran, Moran, Iftah la. And then it goes, you know, like, I don't have the voice today after the concert yesterday.
In each and every type of music I sing, I can find God. Because music is very close to God. It's so magical. I don't know if it affects everybody as it affects me. But listening to music takes me to places. To eternity. You know, you go beyond words, beyond the place. Your soul leaves you, and I feel that. I wake up when I stop singing. I wake up.
The Jewish cemetery in Fez is almost all that remains of what was a large and ancient Moroccan Jewish community. Many of those Jews came to this country after the Christians expelled them from Spain. Among them, the family of the Israeli-born singer Mor Kabasi, who sang to a sold-out audience here. She lights a candle at a tomb and sings me a song about the young and beautiful Sol Tzadika. The prince wanted to marry her. She's buried here.
Cuando Tahra levantó el enredo, sentenciaron a la hermosa Sol.
I came to meet a friend, a woman that has been an inspiration to me for a long time. From the first moment I heard her song and her story, it's a Jewish woman who was forced to convert to Islam, but on refusing to do so, was executed.
It's quite brave of Moore to tell this story and sing this song in a Muslim country. It's quite brave of the Moroccan organisers to have invited her, even if they didn't dare put the I word on the programme.
The festival is all about bringing cultures together. And in the beginning it was, you know, I think as normal when you meet someone you don't know, you don't really feel close to them, or you know, you more focus on the differences. But then as the week passed, eventually we were all like one big hafla, as we say.
Just does that thinking mean?
It means like a big group of people making a big party.
Then in a garden I meet Nordira Pirmatova, a Muslim from Uzbekistan, who's just been singing and strumming a lute under the spreading branches of an enormous Barbary oak.
All my songs just forgot. Love, forgot. Mean, the song got... Give all things for us, our life.
Is it good in a Muslim country to have a festival with different religions?
I like all people. For me, no problem. Very easy, yes. Because yes. Between us, music.
Nordina Pirmatova, ending that report by John Lawrenson from the Fez Sacred Music Festival in Morocco.
And that brings us to the end of this week's show. We hope it was an enlightening experience for you. Join us again next week for more personal stories from around the globe. This week's World Link was produced by Jürgen Kuhn, Neil King and Samantha Early. Don't forget that if you'd like to hear any of the items featured on today's program again, just go to dw.de/worldlink or look us up on iTunes. World Link is brought to you by DW in Bonn. It can lose your life.